Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, my name is Michael Johnston, and this is the New Book in Sociology podcast, a channel on New Books Network. And today I have Dr. Kevin T. Smiley on the show to discuss his book, Market Cities, People Cities, The Shape of Our Urban Future, published by New York University Press. Kevin T. Smiley is an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology at University at Buffalo. Kevin earned a PhD in sociology from Rice University in 2017. He is an environmental and urban sociologist. He analyzes inequalities and exposure to industrial air pollution across neighborhoods and metropolitan areas in the United States. He also researches the city of Copenhagen, Denmark, and Houston, Texas, with particular interest in urban development, public space, climate change, and immigration. Thank you again, Dr. Smiley, for joining us today on New Books in Sociology.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Michael. It's great to be here.
So to start off, could you tell me a little bit about what inspired you to write Market Cities, People Cities, The Shape of Our Urban Future?
Yeah, as far as what really inspired us, when my co-author, Michael Emerson, and I were sitting down to write Market Cities, People Cities, before there was even really a kernel of an idea, we were just struck time and time again about the differences between these two cities we were starting to study. And so each of us at that time was based at Rice University, and we had conducted and been a part of survey research of the city. Michael, my co-author, has deep research roots in the city. And then each of us had the opportunity to travel to Copenhagen, Denmark, him to do some teaching, me as a visiting graduate student. And we were struck immediately by just how different it was. And so this very simplistic observation about how contrasting these two cities were ended up being sort of the foundation from which we proceeded with our entire perspective. So sort of using that, almost you might think of it as an inductive approach, sort of gave us the entryway into thinking about these two cities, because we feel like of a lot of the research in urban studies and urban sociology and beyond is analyzing city after city and often finding similar trends across a lot of cities. But the ways in which cities are dealing with these trends can vary markedly. And we think that Houston and Copenhagen especially constitute two very different ways of dealing with that. And so we were really struck by the contrast because we think it tells us something about the heterogeneity in cities in the 21st century at a time when other folks might be thinking that cities are becoming more and more homogeneous. We're arguing that cities are trying to excel in their own ways, and that can happen in dramatically different fashions. So that was really a big starting point for the book for us, was just the differences we were seeing across our surveys, the differences we were seeing as we talked to people one-on-one in depth, as we just even in our own lived experiences in the city as well.
Excellent. So could you give me an outline as to what a market city is? What do you identify as being a market city and some characteristics of it?
Yeah. When we think about a market city, we're thinking about a city that is comparatively individually oriented. So it's got this sort of individualistic mantra that underlies the culture of the city. This relates in important ways to a couple other facets. First, we think of a market city as having comparatively less centralized and less strong governance systems. So maybe there's not a lot of cooperation across the metropolitan area. Maybe the extent of the sort of things that that government has control over is relatively limited. And so instead, much of the work of governance is left to private sector or public-private actors. So that's another part, is sort of less strong governance systems. And then third, market cities are also characterized by greater inequalities. Social inequalities in terms of economic inequalities across the city, in terms of racial inequalities across the city. That was one of the things that really struck us about market cities. So it sort of comes back to those three aspects. Comparatively weak governance, comparatively high social inequalities, and a sort of individualistic culture. And we call it a market city because we think that the sort of free market mantra is what really courses through those three elements there. And we found that that Houston matches much of what we saw in terms of the market city. By contrast, a lot of what we were seeing in the people city was different than that. And so in a people city, we see a collective orientation in terms of just the way people think culturally. And so people are more trusting, they're more likely to be civically active, things like that. There's also a strong governance system, strong metropolitan governance in terms of inter-municipal cooperation across regional, across the whole metropolitan region. So there's really this strong governance system that's part of it too. And then the third part is that there's comparatively low social inequalities. So that's another part of it too. And that is in fact not just an accident, but a fundamental part of the design insofar as people cities want to try to keep social inequalities as low as they can. And so, and finally, we sort of think of Copenhagen as an ideal, typical people city. And so sort of situating the people city and the market city along the spectrum in Houston and Copenhagen as about as close to the ends of that spectrum as we could probably find out in the post-industrial world today gives us a real sense of the dynamics that we think are occurring in cities today. That heterogeneity I spoke a little bit about earlier is really expressed through that governance. It's expressed through that inequality. It's expressed just how people think in the local culture too.
Excellent. So this theory, this concept, as it comes into play as you walk through, drive through cities, what are some real characteristics in the infrastructure and the way that the city is designed to be able to look back and reflect and say, oh, this is definitely a market city, or this is definitely a people city?
Yeah. And so I'll take your words there, thinking about what distinguishes the infrastructure and land use in the cities, because that is at the core of much of what we talk about. We don't think the built environment is deterministic of people's behavior necessarily or anything like that. But the ways in which, but the places in which we live do have a fundamental effect on us. And so in particular, you sort of mentioned walking or taking a car. In the very first chapter of our book, we sort of sketch a sort of introduction to the cities and by taking a journey in each city. And one of the things that really jumps out in these sort of journeys that we took is that in Houston, the journey is in a car. In Copenhagen, it's on a bicycle. And that's not by personal preference. That's by statistical artifact. The modal transportation type in each city is a car in Houston, where 8 out of 10 people drive alone to work. And in Copenhagen, about half of people are commuting on a bicycle these days. So that's the modal type there. And so the end result is even just before you get to the infrastructure, what you are taking through the infrastructure varies. In Copenhagen, and I think in most people's cities, we would see a comparatively dense infrastructure. And so there's going to be especially an emphasis on mixed uses, the idea that you can use modes other than a car to get to your everyday and your daily round, stores, schools, things of this nature. Particularly an eye for design. And so that these places are championed by urban design that seeks to sort of promote people at every single turn and people's use of that space. By comparison, a market city is going to have is likely to be less dense. Market cities are probably characterized by sprawl. There are often going to have more highways and things like that. And really, one of the core purposes behind land use in a market city is the pursuit of profit, is the pursuit, is thinking of land as a commodity and thinking of how to make the most money off of that commodity. That is a critical and important part of the story, is just how do you fundamentally think about land? And so proceeding from important books within urban sociology, like Urban Fortunes, we know that people, that land is itself a commodity. And both Houston and Copenhagen are nested within a wider capitalist economic system. And so, in fact, both are thinking of land as a commodity. But in Houston, it's taken to its sort of full logical extent. Whereas in Copenhagen, there's trying to be a balance between that reality that land is, in fact, a commodity versus the sort of use values and everyday, daily round attributes and how people attach themselves to place that are core in thinking about the urban design of those. And the end result is that both places look really, really different. And so subsuming these under the same concept struck us as something that we could improve on by thinking about these distinctions between market cities and people cities, because both cities do end up looking very, very different in their lived experience and in this infrastructure in particular.
And one of the things that I want to bring out in this interview is that you make a note to say that not one is better than the other or worse than the other. But in fact, the general public response is that they have a pretty much enjoyable time in either location.
Yeah, that's one of the things that struck us in particular is people like where they live, by and large. And in this case, we mean the city which they live. So they like to live in Houston. They like to live in Copenhagen. We even dipped into data on nearly 80 cities in Europe using survey data from a survey conducted by the European Union. And we found that by and large, in almost every single city of those 80 cities, at least 3 out of 4, often 8 out of 10 or 4 out of 5, sometimes 9 out of 10 people said, yeah, I'm satisfied with my city. I like the city that I live in. And so one of the things that we stress time and time again is although we're trying to raise critical questions about both types of cities and often more critical questions about the market city, we want to really underscore the point that people do like to live in both cities, that both cities are economically doing comparatively fine. Both are global cities that are of some repute. So there's really, it's not that one is necessarily on the up and up versus the other. So while we do think that there are a lot more market cities than people cities in the world right now, it's not to suggest that that people definitely enjoy one more than the other or are more satisfied with one more than the other. In fact, the data just doesn't bear that out. Most people like where they live.
So we can't talk about market cities and people cities without getting into the environmental implications that can be had by the built design of the market city and the built design of the more rural people city. Maybe it's not necessarily rural, but that's what I think of when I think of people cities. But what environmental implications are had by the way in which the city is designed?
Yeah, and so when we're thinking about the environmental implications of cities, we're talking about a very serious issue. In environmental sociology, there is a good deal of discussion about the contradictions of cities. And so some will argue that our cities are here to save us, that by sort of living more densely and coming together, that innovation may happen because people are sort of smooshed up against one another in cities, that that cities could be sort of helpful in building a more sustainable future. But much of the data, especially those marshaled by environmental sociologists, sort of point the other direction, that our cities are full of contradictions. They require immense resources, often extracted from places in the hinterlands and far away from cities, and that cities are not necessarily sustainable in their current form. And so proceeding from that point of departure, that our cities are contested in terms of their environmental implications, we wanted to see, are there differences in the market city model and the people city model as it relates to all of these environmental implications? And we see that it does. And I think in a few important ways. First, we examine just how people think about the environment. In Copenhagen, there is a wide diffusion of the acceptance of climate change. In Houston, in our data, it's a little bit more split. So a lot of people are accepting of the fundamental causes of climate change. That is, they have anthropogenic sources. It's human caused. Whereas about half the population is a little skeptical of climate change. That's not a trend we found in Copenhagen. So just the sheer baseline of how people think as sort of a foundation for any kind of social action or government policy is going to be very different in the cities for that reason alone. And that gets borne out in the actual environmental implications of the city. And so we're able to analyze the potential climate change impacts from very large facilities in the cities and found that Houston emitted considerably more greenhouse gas emissions than Copenhagen. That's even accounting for the fact that Houston is a little bit bigger of a city in terms of population than Copenhagen. Even so, it's just dramatically more in Houston. And then we also saw this in terms of how local actors, particularly in government, but also in civil society beyond government, were thinking through these issues. In Houston, the attention to environmental issues was comparatively constrained. I think a representative way of thinking about this is that the municipal government of Houston has been energetic relating to trying to do green building and things like that. So much of their newest municipal buildings are trying to be LEED certified, which means sort of meeting, sort of a litany of benchmarks for trying to be green. But the catch to some of this is that the Houston municipal government is not necessarily trying to regulate other people beyond its government walls in terms of trying to lessen the environmental footprints. Whereas in Copenhagen, it's not just as narrowly conceived. And in fact, the city is trying to become the first carbon neutral world capital by 2025. And in doing so, they're having to make structural and foundational changes all across the city. So it's not just trying to build new green municipal buildings or retrofit government halls, but it actually touches on private sector. It touches on all manner of aspects of the city, the transportation system, all of these sorts of things in an effort to try to reach that goal. And we talk some about some of the contradictions that come along with trying to be carbon neutral and how exactly do you calculate it then and things like that. But the point stands insofar that Copenhagen is a place that is thinking about its energy sources. It's thinking about transportation. It's thinking about waste, thinking about these things in a sort of much broader sense. And so when we think about environmental implications, that strong governance system and that collective orientation of the residents and government of the city is able to build a much more dramatic response to the deep environmental challenges of our time in a way that a market city just is not able to do so. It's comparatively individualistic. You have a huge percentage of people who do not acknowledge the human sources of climate change. The barriers are real, and that is implicated in terms of Houston is one of the most polluted places in the United States. It's one of the places that is struggling to have sort of a wider governance system to respond to all of these environmental challenges of our time. And so in that way, the environment ended up being, I think, one of a key area of contrast that we saw between the two cities.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And short of completely tearing the city down and rebuilding Houston, is there any way that in their future they can be more environmentally friendly? Is there anything that they can do to reduce the amount of waste that is produced within the city or just the general wastefulness that comes from dense population in the city, as well as using vehicle that produces more carbon than what a bicycle in Copenhagen would?
Yeah, I think there's a couple visions that could be supplied, and really the visions are probably going to come from the residents themselves in an important way. So, there's a couple ways to do it. So you might think of it in terms of just more radical change, of just trying to really fundamentally rethink the market city, and undertaking the sort of long-term work of trying to shift away from being a market city. One of the things we talk about in our concluding chapter is that's really, really hard work. A city can't just start an initiative and 18 months later change from being a market city to a people city. Far from it. History matters. Politics matters. Historical economy matters. So all of these things are putting sort of dramatic, more radical change up against it in some ways. And so that's sort of, one possibility is to think through that, but it's going to take, something really foundational. More than that, though, we talk a little bit about market cities trying to be what we ended up terming big-hearted market cities. The idea that by being more attentive to social inequalities, by being more attentive to climate change, maybe there's a way in which market cities can be more active on these fronts while at the same time trying to do so in a more centralized fashion. And so, one of the things that struck us, take for example, social inequalities. There are a number of exciting, important civil society groups, nonprofits and the like, that are doing incredible work in Houston in an effort to decrease social inequalities, whether it's providing economic opportunities for new arrivals to the city or organizing around environmental issues. There is just a ton of work that is going on in those ways. So the question is, how do you sort of bridge those sorts of work and make that more a core part of the market city just to begin with? In doing so, it's actually going to move you a little bit away from the market city to have that sort of more collective sense, to have a more a strong governance system that recognizes these issues. But we don't think that the city necessarily needs to be torn down or anything like that. As you I think importantly mentioned, this is we are building on top of what we already have. But there are interesting paths forward, and we try to leave it open and try to sketch what we think are some of those paths forward, but largely leave it to the people themselves.
And I don't believe you mentioned anything in the book about edge cities, but as cities start to build outward and suburbanization of America, not a new issue at in any means, but what impact does that have on the market city and the people city? Because as they expand outward, not all little suburban areas or pockets within a city are equal. I think you did mention that about market cities, about the inequalities that exist, and they're much more drastic than what you might see in a people city. But building outward, and how does that impact the way in which we see market cities?
Yes. First and foremost, market cities are going to have more edge cities. They're going to build further outward. They're going to have more of these types of places. Houston is, dozens of miles across in almost every single direction. By contrast, in Copenhagen, first time I lived there, I lived in a suburb and could bike into the central city every day, which would be a complete impossibility in a place like Houston. So sort of using that anecdote, the idea is a market city is going to be characterized by far more edge cities, more of these sprawling places that go further and further out. And the implication of having more of those places is integral because they can expose and emphasize social differentiation across space. So by having more places like this and people being further away from each other, the part of the purpose is to try to build advantages. People are trying to move to better school systems. They're trying to build up their home values, things of this nature. And those are the sort of inequalities that we end up seeing across places that are characteristic of the market city. Whereas in a people city, we're not seeing such gaping differences between property values from neighborhood to neighborhood or from municipality to municipality or suburbs to cities. There are differences, yes, but they're not nearly as large of those as we see in the market city. And so that relates right back to that core foundation that market cities are higher in social inequality. And so the question is, how does that get embedded across physical geographic space? And it does so through things like sprawl, through things like the creation of these edge cities, which are partly there to be sort of a more fractured and differentiated social system. They're supposed to be not particularly integrated with each other because it's this individualistic culture where we can all sort of try to achieve what we can achieve. And that includes our own spatial attainment in terms of the places in which we're trying to live. And certainly a market city with sprawl is extending inequality just through this physical expansion of the city.
And then this could lead to a conversation about tax base and how taxes and how money is made to maintain roadways, to maintain infrastructure, to maintain a style of living for a market city or for a people city. If I remember correctly, Kevin, you said that in people cities, the tax base is extremely important for the well-being of the city, but in market cities, he wrote that a large amount of the income is coming from large businesses and the money that they are donating to the city to help maintain infrastructure, to help maintain the design of the city.
Yes, and so taxes end up being another area of contrast between the places. One critical way to think about it is the inequality within each city. And so in Copenhagen, There's sort of a progressive tax structure, but it's also a tax structure that taxes everyone at relatively high rates. And that provides a groundswell of money that can be used for all of these sort of land use improvements and public space and trying to be ambitious environmentally. All of those sorts of things are fueled in part by having this huge tax base just to begin with. Whereas in the market city, it really just varies a lot. Perhaps the one commonality is that taxes tend to be relatively low. But sometimes the tax system itself is used to fund that differentiation across space. And so in a place like Houston, where, as we counted it up, I think there's nearly 200 different governments. You think about municipal governments, school systems, all of these sorts, county governments, all of these different government systems, each is drawing on a different sort of tax base from a different sort of place. And so a comparatively affluent municipality that's on the edge of the city or somewhere else might be able to draw a lot stronger of a tax base in for its school systems and things like that. Whereas the municipality of Houston, which is not as affluent as many of its suburban neighbors, and as well as many suburban municipalities in Houston, are not as affluent either. So having these sort of distinctions between place to place to place will then lead to a lot of inequalities in terms of, well, what can that local government do? What sort of things can it provide? What kind of public spaces is it trying to build? And then secondarily, it relates especially to the education system, because then that can fuel educational inequalities. But market cities are highly tolerant of that. You know, that's sort of the part of the local mantras we have all these inequalities across places, and that's sort of okay. Certainly, there are more than a few people who are contesting this educational inequality in Houston and other market cities all across the world, but it is built into the system that there should be these social inequalities in terms of the tax base, in terms of just the money that we're collecting together as a group of people and as a society and saying that we want to spend to try to further ourselves. That's different. It depends on where you live, especially in a market city. It doesn't depend on where you live as much in a people city.
And in the two, you saw a difference in the balance of power in terms of strong central government or weak central government. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. I think one of the things that really struck us, especially, is this idea of regional or metropolitan governance. Increasingly, we've outgrown our single municipalities. And so maybe 200 years ago, when 3% of the world was urban, it made sense to think of a single city as being within a single government. But the reality of the matter is that huge numbers of people do not live in the central municipality of a metropolitan area. They live in a suburban area. They live in an outlying ex-urban area, things like that. In Houston, for instance, it is projected that really any day now, it may have just happened in 2018, it may happen next year, Harris County, that unincorporated areas in Harris County, which is the central county, which contains Houston. But that unincorporated areas that are not in a municipality, will be the most populous place in the Houston area. So eventually, more people, again, this is at present, will live in unincorporated Harris County, not even in a city, than any other place. And so that's, in practice, that's about 2 million people. That's more people than live even in the city of Houston. And so the sort of implication that then comes from this is relating exactly to these strong governance and weak governance issues. Is if you have a patchwork of governments, like I said, in Houston, nearly 200 municipal, school, transportation authorities, what have you, if you have this patchwork of governance across the city, then it can be very hard to deal with and build towards collective outcomes in the city. Copenhagen has taken sort of a different tack. And so the national government, for instance, in 2007, instituted a wholesale change that changed the number of municipalities in the country from about 300 to 100, and the number of what we might think of as counties or states from about 12 to 5. The effect of this was to create more nimble units by which local change can be carried out. And so there's actually a very strong national state in Denmark, which actually provides quite a bit of the funding for municipalities such as the municipality of Copenhagen and some of the outlying suburban areas. But by having this structure where there are just fewer municipalities, there are where regional cooperation is encouraged, whereas regional transportation systems are meant to bridge from place to place to place for across neighborhoods, across municipalities, even in Copenhagen, across countries, across the Sound to Sweden. And so having that ends up playing a big role. And so and all of those things are possible in part because of this strong governance system that links people across these places in purposeful ways. Whereas Houston has also been built in a purposeful way to not have to live in a municipality or to live in a different area and put your taxes towards a better school system or something like that. So that's a weak metropolitan governance system, but it can be highly advantageous for the most socially, economically advantaged people within the Houston area.
And the interesting piece is you still see in both types of city, people are generally satisfied as people who live in these cities. They're equally satisfied now, whether that has something to do with preference or whether that has something to do with general reality and enlightenment of knowing that that's where that person is going to be. Therefore, they must be happy or satisfied with where they're living at. Is one and the other, and is and would be useful for further research.
And to be clear, you know, people, there's a lot of reasons people can like their city. It's a fairly general question when you ask people, are you satisfied with the city that you live in? Maybe they're thinking about the local government around them. Maybe they're just thinking about how they like their neighbors. Both of those things really, really matter and are important sociologically. So. It's not necessarily always that they even love the market city system or they love the people city system, but they may have a sort of closer attachment to place. And more than that, people aren't able to pick and choose where they live. And human beings are highly constrained in our choices of the places that we're going to live. And that's especially true in terms of picking up and moving to another city. So we don't think about it in terms of, oh, people have sort of self-sorted into market cities or people cities. Like there's not even a kernel of truth to that sort of thing. So there's something about just having that sheer attachment to place, which urban sociologists have talked about for a long time, but that is probably driving a lot of that satisfaction just in and of itself.
Well, and the tribalism that comes behind it, I think of rural Iowa, and when you have school systems that are starting to decline in number of enrollment, the public schools particularly, and then you see them combining with other cities, it tends to be a fight tooth and nail until the death of one of those schools, even when they are considering closing down because they don't have enough resources to keep their doors open. It's something that these people take pride in. They take pride in their city. They take pride in their school. There's a history. There's a pride in place, as you were just talking about.
Yeah, and one of the things we've tried to emphasize talking about market cities and people cities is that culture. It's a culture. It's a way of thinking. It's a way of going about and moving through your city. It's the sort of logic and justifications that underline politics. It's that. Affects how you think about your daily round. So all of those sorts of things matter, that people are really, really connected to the places in which they live. And that is a powerful motivator for the sorts of actions you're willing to take or not willing to take, or even just the sheer sort of things that may come to mind in a city in terms of trying to take some sort of action to do something about your city. It's really going to be affected by those underlying cultural things going on within each sort of place. And we think a market city and a people city really furnish different cultural logics, different justifications that play a large role here.
Well, we're all out of time, but one final question. What are you up to now?
Yeah, got a lot of exciting work moving forward, continuing to do research on disparities across metropolitan areas in terms of industrial air pollution. So that really relates to this book work because we're thinking about what makes cities distinct, what makes cities characterized by a ton of industrial air pollution versus characterized by comparatively less. So that's a major line of work I'm working on. And then another item on my agenda is thinking through disasters, and particularly urban flooding. So I've got some new work on Houston and elsewhere that's looking at land cover changes across time and how we're changing from more natural landscapes to anthropogenic ones. And what are the implications for social inequalities within that? So the particular question I'm focusing on is how does the production of advantage spaces, transforming natural landscapes into anthropogenic ones, create advantage spaces that then also lead to disadvantages in the form of environmental risks for during times of urban flooding for disadvantaged groups. And so this is a major part of what I'm sort of thinking about moving forward. And it relates to all of these issues we've been talking about concerning governance, concerning inequalities, and especially differentiation across space. And then finally, these environmental implications. In the era of climate change, you know, the impacts from natural disasters are just going to be heightened. And so what are we doing about it? And what are the implications of it are going to be very important in terms of building more sustainable and more resilient societies moving forward.
Do you see this as being a book project or a more of an article?
It's going to be, at this point, more articles at this, moving forward. That's primarily where I'm going with it.
All right. Well, I look forward to diving into those and reading more about them. Please let me know once they're out.
Of course.